Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Supreme Court sides with protesters at military funerals. Here's attorney Margie Phelps for the Westboro Baptist Church.
We're telling you your stinking theater is on fire, and we will continue to tell you that. We have not slowed down, thank God, and we will not.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker appeals to the public in his battle with unions.
The facts are clear. Wisconsin is broke, and it's time to start paying our bills today so our kids are not stuck with even bigger bills tomorrow.
And strong words from President Obama as Libya battles on.
The violence must stop. Muammar Gaddafi has lost legitimacy to lead, and he must leave.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines with Daniel Dombey of the Financial Times, Aaron Billings of Roll Call, and On Point's Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What should the U.S. role be in Libya? What's the message from Wisconsin? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Dan Dombey of the Financial Times, thanks for being with us.
My absolute pleasure.
Aaron Billings with Roll Call, great to have you as well.
Hi, Jane.
And hello, Jack. Nice to have you, as always.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
We'll begin in Libya as forces loyal to Muammar Gaddafi have fired tear gas at protesters marching in the capital, Tripoli, today. Also today, the UN Refugee Agency says that heavily armed pro-Gaddafi forces are now manning the Libyan side of the border with Tunisia, which is preventing refugees from leaving that country. Dan Dombey, how do you view the situation in Libya right now?
Well, it's a very difficult situation because what's clear is that there is a concerted effort by Colonel Gaddafi to fight back. You have two sets of rebels. You have people in the west where there are really a few cities that are coming under increasing pressure from Gaddafi. And you have a much larger rebel enclave in the east. The real fear, I think, is that some of those places in the west will fall to Gaddafi, who has been attacking them relentlessly over the last few days. And so we've been really focused here in Washington on this debate about a no-fly zone and about Western intervention. And at the end of that debate, really, we're not very close to a no-fly zone. We're not very close to Western intervention right now. But what's happening on the ground is that the rebels in the west of the country are coming under real pressure. And obviously Gaddafi is using ever more force against people in Tripoli itself.
Hmm. Let's dig into that no-fly zone issue. Speaking before the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Wednesday, Defense Secretary Robert Gates discussed the implications of placing a no-fly zone over Libya.
There's a lot of, frankly, loose talk about some of these military options, and let's just call a spade a spade. A no-fly zone begins with an attack on Libya to destroy the air defenses. That's the way you do a no-fly zone.
And in a congressional hearing yesterday, Senator John McCain said that a no-fly zone over Libya should be considered as a serious option.
I don't think it's loose talk on the part of the people on the ground in Libya, nor the Arab League, nor others, including the Prime Minister of England, that this option should be given the strongest consideration.
So, Dan Dombey, a lot of discussion this week about a no-fly zone. Obviously, other options for intervention in Libya. Where are we in deciding whether to intervene or not, or how to do it?
Well, we're not very far down the road, to be absolute honest. The U.S. has sent two amphibious attack boats with about 2,000 Marines and one other destroyer through the Suez Canal to the Mediterranean, but that's nowhere near enough force to kind of be involved in a military intervention of any kind. This idea of a no-fly zone was initially floated by the White House last week. It was floated by Hillary Clinton. And then almost immediately you saw really strong pushback. You saw strong pushback by the Turks. You saw strong pushback by the Russians. That made clear that neither the UN Security Council nor NATO would, as things stand, authorize such a no-fly zone. And there's a real fear within the Obama administration of anything that looks like unilateral military intervention. So there was a pulling back from that. At the same time, the Pentagon is very wary about these kind of things because it knows that unless you bomb first, you could have pilots shot down. There was a similar debate ahead of the no-fly zone and the actions that took place in Bosnia in the 1990s. So at the end of all of that, we've had an agonized debate here in Washington, and it's fairly clear that unless the situation on the ground deteriorates and there becomes a real situation in which Gaddafi is killing people even at an even greater rate than he is right now, we're not going to see that military intervention. I would add, however, that the US is also looking at other possibilities. Right now it's focusing on humanitarian intervention in terms of flying refugees from Libya back to Egypt. There are also ideas about securing ports, airports, safe zones, stop the oil fields. Those actually may require fewer resources than a no-fly zone across the whole country.
Aaron Billings, you're there in Washington. How much has Congress focused on the situation in Libya with so many domestic issues right now at the boiling point?
Well, there's a lot of multitasking going on. I think everybody knows that's Congress is always trying to do more than probably it can. We have obviously a big budget debate going on and trying to keep the government funded. But certainly this is atop the priority list. I think members of Congress across the board are concerned. You know, there's a diversity of opinion. The president obviously came out appearing to take a stronger tack yesterday, you know, indicating that a military role was possibly in his sights, mentioned Gaddafi by name, said he no longer has legitimacy and needs to go. I think those words were welcome on Capitol Hill. But look, I mean, this is a very precarious situation, and I don't think there is any unanimity on Capitol Hill about how it should be dealt with, how quickly it should be dealt with, and what tactics should be employed.
You mentioned the president, Aaron. Here he is speaking on the crisis in Libya and expressing the U.S.'s support for the country's citizens.
The United States and the entire world continues to be outraged by the appalling violence against the Libyan people. The United States is helping to lead an international effort to deter further violence, put in place unprecedented sanctions to hold the Gaddafi government accountable, and support the aspirations of the Libyan people.
Jack Beatty, do you believe a military role is in President Obama's sights?
Well, it may be in his sights, but it may not be in prospect. I think Dan really had it right. Short of exemplary, that is to say, things seen on mass killings by Colonel Gaddafi's forces, I don't think the pressure will be there. And reading today's Times, it sounds as if the Gaddafi people have resorted to almost discreet, you know, body snatchings in Tripoli, going after people almost individually whom they've seen on television and in photographs, trying to round up people that way. And if he keeps the level of violence down below sort of a threshold of conscience in the Western world, and one doesn't know what that is, then I don't think there's going to be much. There may be talk, but it really seems so improbable that, well, Hillary Clinton has said we will offer any kind of assistance to the Benghazi rebels, but that really, it's hard to imagine what that would be. And this is only a week after Secretary Gates at West Point said, you know, that next time a defense secretary comes to a president and says, let's intervene in have a military intervention in the Middle East, the defense secretary should have it. Someone should say to him, "You've got to have your head examined." That's just a week ago he said that, and so for all these reasons, it just seems very unlikely unless the threshold of violence just rises and rises.
Dan Dombey, what about Secretary Gates's comments at West Point? Are those remarks still reverberating with regard to Libya?
Yeah, I mean, what he said was the next time a president talks about a big land war in the Middle East or in Asia or in Africa, he ought to have his head examined in the so delicate terms of General Douglas MacArthur. Now, Secretary Gates and his spokesman both say that what they're talking about is the future of warfare. There's also what they're talking about is really trying to get organizations like the army out of their comfort zone, that the future of war is not big motorized divisions or tanks or anything like that. And many people see in a time a straitened resources, the most important investment is the Navy and the Pacific against a rising China. However, all of that said, what he's talking about clearly is a country that has, in the eyes of the military, enough, more than enough to do already. With Afghanistan, still with this residual presence in Iraq, with the whole presence in the Gulf vis-a-vis Iran, with ever more developments vis-a-vis China. And so there is this sense of world war weariness. And there's also a sense that the US is not able to just spend the resources that it was in the past. It's not a country of infinite resource.
Dan, let me interrupt you to get a listener in on this point. Steve is calling from Windham, Connecticut. Hi, Steve. Welcome to On Point.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. You got to wonder where Gates was and Admiral Mullen was at the start of Iraq. They seem perfectly sane. But how far morally should we go? I mean, body snatching, as long as the West, as long as Gaddafi keeps body snatching, is that okay with us in general? I mean, where is the line where we should, I mean, the future warfare is Libya. I mean, I'm not for sending troops. I think it's the same approach, but where is the moral line?
Steve, thank you.
We should get involved.
Aaron Billings, I'll give you the last word in answer to Steve's question. These moral questions, are they top of mind on Capitol Hill in Washington?
I mean, I think the president wrestles with this all the time. I mean, to Dan's point, that you know, we've got, there are so many, if I don't know if I should say international crises, but there, you know, we've got so much disruption across the globe, and you know, intervention is. It's a big deal, and deciding when and how, you know, I think these are the most difficult questions a president faces, and clearly Obama has enough of them in front of him.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing the week in the news with a terrific panel today. Aaron Billings from Roll Call, Dan Dombey of the Financial Times, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's go now to Wisconsin, where thousands of state workers are bracing for the possibility of pink slips. Today, Governor Scott Walker says he will issue 1,500 layoff notices unless at least one Senate Democrat returns for a vote on this legislation stripping state workers of collective bargaining rights. Here's Governor Walker telling the Wisconsin legislature this week that his proposed budget keeps the best interests of his state in mind, and he quotes the state's constitution to make his point.
Our constitution says the blessings of a free government can only be maintained by a firm adherence to justice, moderation, temperance, frugality, and virtue. This is the heart of our budget. We are returning to frugality and making the long-term decisions to balance our budget now and, more importantly, into the future.
Jack Beatty, Wisconsin State Democrats are still hiding out in Illinois. How long can they keep this up?
Yes, and I'm not clear. Perhaps Aaron can help us, but it doesn't. Are they being paid, Aaron? Do we know whether that's happening?
I don't know. I don't know if they're being paid. I do know. I think there are 14 of them that are, holding up somewhere, and obviously the governor's trying to compel them to come back, try to force them to vote on this budget. It's this is a made for TV movie. Is it not? I mean. It's high stakes, high drama.
So, Aaron, how does it look like the American people are on the side of unions here or not? I mean, how is this issue of unions clashing with budgets? How is it playing out in different parts of the country?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, as much as this is a fiscal debate, it is also a political debate. I mean, this really underscores, I think, the ideological differences between Democrats and Republicans when it comes to unions. A lot of Democrats obviously feel like this is a witch hunt, that they are actually, you know, unfairly targeting unions. Obviously, unions have been a constituency group of Democrats for many, many years. And so, you know, I think that's what you're seeing on the Democratic side. Republicans, of course, are making the argument that, look, we are in a budget crisis. This is not just in Wisconsin. We're seeing something similar play out in Ohio. They actually have something on the table that's, you know, far more sweeping than what Governor Walker is looking at. You know, but there is also the risk of overreaching. I mean, you know, you go too far, and these are, you know, we're looking at or not just collective bargaining, but we're looking at, you know, at state workers and at a time when people are very much concerned about getting food on the table. I mean, you know, workers are workers. So, but like I said at the top, this is very much an ideological debate, whether or not the role of unions just generally and whether they still have a legitimate place in our political culture.
So, Aaron, go ahead, Jack.
Well, I was just going to say that the public opinion is in this week. Polls from the New York Times, from Pew, from NBC, Wall Street Journal, even Rasmussen, all showing overwhelming public support for collective bargaining rights for unions. Yes to union givebacks to make things go, but very strongly, 71% of the public in the NBC poll wants collective bargaining rights preserved. How to balance the budget? You ask the public. 22% say cut benefits for state employees. 40% say raise taxes. So Governor Walker is, and now he may be about to be joined by Governor Kasich in Ohio. They're way out ahead of, or behind, or in any case, not in sync with what seems to be broad public opinion, at least at this point.
But what about a domino effect, Aaron? If Governor Walker is successful here, do you see that that will embolden other states with similar crises? There are many of them.
It very well could. I mean, but to Jack's point, in Ohio, I believe there was a Republican legislator yesterday on the floor saying, "Look, we, you know, and this is a Republican who doesn't have a reputation for being, you know, a pro." Union member saying, "Look, we do risk overreaching here. We do risk going too far, and there could be a backlash. We do not have, you know, Republicans certainly won at the ballot box in November, but we don't necessarily have a mandate." But yes, I mean, certainly this could spark other Republican governors, Republican legislators to try to take, you know, to follow the same path. But if this does backfire, if the public truly you know, reacts unfavorably, negatively, you know, it could stop here.
Let's get a listener in on this. Anami is calling from Charlotte, Vermont. Welcome to the program. Nice to have you.
Hello, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling about the situation in Wisconsin. I feel a lot of the public funds, pension funds, have been invested in Wall Street. And it was Wall Street unscrupulous dealing and bamboozling the people that lost a lot of the money. Wall Street got bailed out. Wall Street, the bankers, they get money and bonuses, and they get it at the expense of working people. There's a relationship between low public funds and the lost money.
So we bailed out Wall Street with millions and millions, and yet we're being stingy with these ordinary working Americans. I got it. Anami, thank you very much. Daniel Dombey, I know you've been watching these union battles in Wisconsin. How do you see this?
Well, I mean, I think that the sentiment that Anami just expressed is a very strongly held one by many people, and particularly there is a sense of injustice here. But on the other hand, there is also a sense that the days of bailouts have certainly come to a pause right now because of the financial straits that the US economy now finds itself in. What I find striking, just viewing the whole Wisconsin issue, which I think is absolutely fascinating, is that halfway into his mandate, Barack Obama is presiding over witnessing a US political landscape that has shifted, where the fights have shifted so far to the right. Who would have thought when Barack Obama was elected in November 2008, we would be talking about this scale of cuts that are currently being negotiated between Congress and the White House, or indeed about this kind of attack on collective bargaining rights? There was an awful lot of talk about a new liberal dawn, and Barack Obama was probably the most old-fashioned liberal to be elected since Jimmy Carter in 1976. But I just see the political landscape in the U.S. as having moved considerably to the right, and the fight in Wisconsin is part of that.
Here's Sam in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it. Great program. Couldn't disagree more with the last caller. I mean, I don't know that the political landscape has shifted to the right. I think the dialogue has shifted to the right, but the people haven't. I think that what's most inspiring to me in the news this week is just seeing the spread of democracy through the Middle East. It's just an unstoppable wave. These are people that are risking their lives for democracy, and I'm very optimistic that this sort of fever is going to catch on in the United States, because I think most Americans haven't shifted to the right. I know Jack talked about most Americans want collective bargaining. That's true. 60% want a single-payer system. 60% oppose the Afghan war. 80% oppose the Citizen United decision. And 60% increase would rather see a tax increase on the wealthy than cutting. So the fact of the matter is the majority of the people are not going along with the political dialogue, and sooner or later the people in the United States, I'm hopeful, you know, won't take it anymore, and they'll take a lesson from the Middle East, and I'm very inspired by the events.
Sam, I'm glad you called. Thank you very much. Let's take one more. Cleve is in Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Cleve. Welcome to On Point.
Hi.
Hi,
Dee.
Hi. Go ahead.
I'm a taxi driver, and I very much agree with the last gentleman's point. This is such a host or such a street language BS that we're hearing about the lack of money, about this country being broke and not having resources. This is the richest country in the world. If this country is broke, then what do you say about the entire world? The problem is that the priorities of those running the country are totally backward. Balancing the budget can be done by using the money going to the military, the CIA, et cetera. They're playing no progressive role anywhere in the world. All the money is going to the dictators and rulers who are oppressing and slaughtering people who are fighting for justice. Also, the tax base should be changed to level enough taxes on the super rich. And also, talk about cuts. If any cuts should go down, it should be cut in the salaries of the governmental official, the politician across the board, down to that of the average pay of your average worker. That's where we should start.
Cleve, I'm glad you called with reference to Wisconsin. Aaron, wrap us up here. How do you see this ending?
Well, I guess it depends on if they can get these 14 state legislators back.
Yeah.
I think one way or the other, this governor is going to try to pass this budget. And we'll see. I mean, you know, I think time will tell.
Let's go now to the U.S. budget showdown. And with only 2 weeks to go before a stopgap funding bill runs out, the White House and Tea Party-backed Republicans in Congress still face huge disagreements over how much to immediately cut from domestic programs over the next 6 months. Aaron Billings, do you see either side in much of a hurry to move on their positions here?
Well, I think what we have to do first, next week the Senate is going to take up both of these continuing resolution proposals. One is the Republican House-backed, House-passed bill, and then the other is this new Democratic plan, which calls for cutting an additional $6.5 billion in spending. Both are expected to fail, and then we're going to come to the negotiating table. Obviously, the Vice President was on Capitol Hill yesterday meeting with congressional leaders to try to at least begin discussions, begin negotiations. We're not there yet. They passed a short-term CR to keep the government funded for 2 weeks. Yep. That was signed into law on Wednesday. That'll at least buy some time for these guys. But look, no one wants a government shutdown, and people are going to have to compromise. Those are the two things that I can tell you with with assurance.
Let me play a clip here. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, before taking part in yesterday's bipartisan budget meeting, he criticized what he sees as Democratic inaction on this issue.
Neither the White House nor a single Democrat in Congress has proposed a plan that would allow the government to remain open and that would respond to the voters by reining in spending. All we get is talk.
And prior to Thursday's budget meeting between House and Senate leaders, Congresswoman Karen Bass told ABC News that her fellow Democrats are ready to cut spending so long as it's done carefully.
Democrats have already demonstrated that they do agree that cuts are necessary. The question is where. It's a matter of cutting with surgical precision.
So, Dan Dombey, with the U.S. strapped for cash right now, what's giving in our budget for international affairs? What do you think?
Well, I think this is a really interesting story, to be honest, too, because there's so much talk about cuts, and yet the focus is on such a small proportion of total government spending. We're talking about that part of government spending which is discretionary non-defence spending. So all the entitlements, which is where the real money is, Social Security, Medicare and so on, that's off the table in this discussion. The Pentagon is essentially off the table in this discussion. Secretary Gates is talking, is outraged that the defence budget may not go up as much as he wants it to for the rest of this year. But no one's talking about cuts there. We're talking about that very small part of the budget, which is discretionary non-defence spending, which means that things like, for example, humanitarian assistance, State Department spending and so on, is really in the crosshairs here. And what we're talking about, for example, is things like the programs that George W. Bush championed for malaria, fighting malaria and AIDS in Africa. We're talking about the State Department budget as it deals with issues like Iraq, Afghanistan and Pakistan. And Secretary Clinton is very, very worried indeed that this is going to be a real hit to U.S. national security.
In fact, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spent a lot of time on Capitol Hill this week. Here she is telling members of the House Foreign Affairs Committee that she reduced that if the reduced State Department budget passed by the House last month goes into law, it would harm American interests.
The 16% cut for state and USAID that passed the House last month would be devastating for our national security. It would force us to scale back dramatically on critical missions in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. And as Secretary Gates, Admiral Bullen, General Petraeus have all emphasized to the Congress, we need a fully engaged and fully funded national security team, and that includes state and USAID.
Jack Beatty, does it look like Hillary Clinton's testimony might keep the State Department's budget flush?
Well, you know, the one a week ago, there was a big poll about what the public thinks about spending. And basically, they want more spending on education, job training, research, infrastructure, and the like, all things the Republicans have cut in this $61 billion cut for this year. But the one thing the public agrees should be cut is foreign aid, foreign assistance. The public has the idea that this is an immense part of the budget. I think it's less than 1%. So the secretary's got her work cut out for her in talking to broader opinion about this. But, you know, talking about work cut out for you, the Republicans really have a dilemma here. Their cuts in the short term are not popular. And overwhelmingly, according to the latest NBC poll, the public rejects any idea of cutting Medicare by 81%. They don't want Medicare cut by 77%. They don't want Social Security cut. What do they want? A millionaire's surtax to take care of any problems in Social Security or Medicare, somehow means testing, and perhaps a raise in the retirement age. So why are the Republicans pushing things that are so seemingly unpopular? This was caught in a brilliant metaphor by Bill McInturff, the pollster who took the poll, Republican pollster. He said, it may be hard to understand why a person might jump off a cliff unless you understand they're being chased by a tiger. That tiger is the Tea Party. The Tea Party is chasing the GOP over this cliff. 7 in 10 members of the Tea Party want drastic cuts today. They want bigger cuts tomorrow in entitlements. And more than half of the public does not, general public, does not want those things. So the there's the cliff and the Tea Party, the tiger, right on the tail of the Republicans.
Aaron Billings, how do you see the Tea Party voice working into this debate?
Well, I mean, I'll say this. I think Speaker John Boehner is going to have to really do a lot of work to make sure that those 87 freshmen, many of whom were elected on a Tea Party platform, get on board with whatever they're ending up with in the end here. It's going to be a challenge. I mean, he's obviously going to have to convince them that whatever level of cuts they can arrive at is palatable, is acceptable. But look, I mean, these guys all got elected on this, you know, anti-spending, you know, anti-government, or not anti-government, but, you know, smaller government platform, pro-constitution, constitutional tenet platform. And they certainly have a voice, and the Republican leadership is listening. Now, I will also say this, though. Coming in, both Majority Leader Eric Cantor and Boehner said, we do not want a government shutdown. You know, there won't be a government shutdown. And I think they have impressed that upon many of these Tea Party members.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about a very busy week in the news and in some other headlines now. Apple CEO Steve Jobs came off medical leave to make a surprise appearance at the launch of the iPad 2.
Good morning. Thanks for coming.
TV actor Charlie Sheen was everywhere this week, lashing out. Here, he says what it would take to get him back to the set of Two and a Half Men.
I'm a man of my word, so I will finish the TV show. I'll even do season 10, but it's at this point because of psychological distress. Oh, my God. It's 3 mil an episode. Take it or leave it.
Actress Jane Russell died this week at the age of 89. She was best known for co-starring with Marilyn Monroe in the 1953 film Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
A kiss may be grand, but it won't pay the rental on your humble flat or help you at the automat. Man.
And listeners, you can join our conversation. What has moved your world this week? Jack Beatty is with us this hour. So is Aaron Billings of Roll Call and Dan Dombey of the Financial Times. To presidential politics 2012 now. On Thursday, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich announced plans to launch a website that may lead to a run for the presidency.
Because of our concern for the future of the country, our concern for our grandchildren and all of the children of this country who are faced with, I think, a very dramatic choice of which future we're going to have. We are today establishing a website, NewtExplore2012.com.
So Aaron Billings, he's exploring the plan to start an exploratory committee. Why
such? He's exploring an exploration
right.
of exploring.
Right. So why such hesitancy?
You know, I don't really know. I mean, it just was bizarre. I think, you know, it was funny. You know, we were actually reporting about Newt, you know, launching this exploratory committee, or what we all thought was going to be a launch of an exploratory committee. And his spokesman that, you know, the night before, I guess it was Wednesday night, you know, sent out this press statement saying he is not doing this and anybody who's saying this is wrong and it's, you know, it's inaccurate and this, that, and the other thing. It's bizarre. It's just, it's odd. I mean, I maybe there's a reluctance to be, you know, kind of the first one sort of officially out of the gate. But, you know, the clock is ticking and considering we're kind of in perma-campaign anymore in this country, you know, I'm not quite sure why the Republicans are, you know, not just jumping in. I do think, though, in the next couple months, we're going to start to see these, you know, the candidates decide once and for all whether they're going to actually take the plunge. And I will say on Newt Gingrich, you know, I just I'm not sure if he, you know, if he could win the nomination. I mean, it's maybe he could. Maybe I'm wrong. But I think he has a he would have a tough time, I think.
Here's a comment from our website, onpointradio.org, from Acton. Newt Gingrich was sanctioned $300,000 by the House for ethics violations, resigned the speakership in disgrace, admitted to marital infidelities that led to two divorces, was carrying on an affair while impeaching Clinton for one, and yet is still being treated as a leading Republican contender. That says a lot about the Republican field. Jack Beatty, how do you see this presidential campaign cycle stacking up? How does it compare with those past?
Well, I read the other day that at this time in, what would that be, 2007, 12 candidates had declared in both parties, and thus far nobody, of course, I guess the putative candidacy of President Obama. And why the Republicans are being so slow about it, I think that does tie into what's happening in Congress. They know that tiger, the Tea Party, it's not only chasing the House GOP leadership over the cliff of spending and austerity, it could be chasing them. They're going to have to take positions if they declare on some of these seemingly very unpopular positions the Republicans have either advocated or want to advocate. So the longer they can put that off, I think the better. And for them, and then with Mr. Gingrich, you know, he would bring a lot of excitement to the race. He's intellectually alive. There are a few people in American politics who are just as interesting as he is, who have as fertile and abundant a mind. On the other hand, the ethical issues around him are just so huge. I mean, his organization, American Solutions, raised $14 million last year. and spent $13 million and change of it, $2 million of that, according to reports, for plane fares and limousines. And the question with Newt is one raised really by his ex-wife in an Esquire interview a year or so ago, where she said, you know, will he run for president, or will he just use that as a scam to raise money? Because he has run scams. I mean, he ran a scam where he sent lists to people, you know, announcements saying, you've been selected as entrepreneur of the year. We'll send you a gavel from Speaker Gingrich. And, of course, you had to pay $5,000 to get the gavel, and he sent it to a strip club in one case in Dallas, and the woman says, fine, I'll pay the $5,000, and apparently if you go in there, you can see the plaque. So he's been known to run these sorts of quote-unquote scams on the web, and so I think Republicans who are going to be giving him money have to ask, is he serious about this now, or is this just a kind of, you know, Newt fundraising deal?
Dan Dombey, how do you see this? Weigh in here.
Well, I think that this is the classic issue, isn't it, that the generic Republican candidate does better than the actual human beings that are likely to run. The Republicans clearly have a big opportunity in 2012, given the unemployment rate in this country. If it still sticks around 9% or above, then President Obama is going to be vulnerable. But the actual people who are likely to run all have deep problems in terms of getting the nomination or winning the general election, and the front runner is still Mitt Romney, who has problems on both fronts. I think fundamentally, however, it is going to be unemployment that decides things. If unemployment is where it is right now, it is going to be hard for Obama, even for facing a less than perfect Republican candidate. If unemployment goes down a couple of points, he's looking pretty. I would say that one of the interesting things is that President Obama seems to have eliminated one of the Democrats' traditional weak points, which is national security. Because he's increased spending on the Pentagon, because he's ramped on the war on the Afghanistan, he's discontented his base. But actually, if you look at the polls, people are generally more happy with Obama's foreign policy than with his domestic policy. It's an entirely different question, however, whether it's really worth that kind of investment and putting troops in that kind of in harm's way if it's purely political calculation.
Aaron Billings, do you see President Obama, for lack of a better word, posturing a little more you know, as we roll up to presidential politics 2012?
You bet. Yes. I mean, you know, look at the health care law, for example. I mean, talking about providing flexibility to the states on implementation, I think, is one example. But, yeah, I mean, you know, he's already getting his campaign in order. He is saying the right things. He really wants to get a deal on this, you know, on spending in the budget. He wants to kind of reprise his role as we coined it the other day, deal maker in chief, as he did at the end of the year on the tax extensions, the tax cut extensions from Bush too. So certainly, and I think we're going to see more of it. And, you know, I do think, you know, to Dan's point, obviously, I think unemployment will be atop everyone's mind as they head into this next election cycle. But I think Obama will be formidable. Is he guaranteed another term? No. But I think he I think it's advantage Obama at this point.
Let's go to a listener from Tiffin, Iowa. Hi, Joyce. Welcome to On Point. Glad you called.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. In my opinion, the Republicans are not jumping in because we have a born-again Republican president who already does everything they want.
So you see Obama with a certain perspective, Joyce. Thank you. Jack Biddy, any thoughts to wrap this up?
Well, I gather Joyce is referring to the president's endorsement of two more years of tax cuts for the very rich as the price of his compromise with the Republicans in December to preserve unemployment benefits. But the president has said that that's going to be the issue of the next campaign, the $700 billion over 10-year tax cut for the very richest. He's going to make that an issue, and public opinion would seem to support him there. So, yes, he for a while, he was in sync with the Republicans on that, but it's the clock is running. I think, though, that Joyce does make a point, and it connects to something that Dan makes, that in foreign policy especially, the president has taken a very Republican line, especially in Afghanistan, where god-awful stuff this week, nearly, what, nine boys were killed accidentally by a NATO plane. You know, there were 500. The number of attacks has just risen from, in 2005, there were 465 insurgent attacks. Just in January, there were 1,300. This is a policy going nowhere.
Let's go to the United States Supreme Court now, which ruled this week in favor of the Westboro Baptist Church, which has picketed military funerals. Here's Albert Schneider, father of a slain soldier who filed suit, reacting to the ruling on CBS.
I think everybody should be buried in peace. I think if our forefathers were alive today and saw this, we wouldn't even have to worry about this going to court because they would have been put in front of a firing squad for treason.
Aaron Billings, I'll turn to you on this controversial ruling, at least to the public. What did it say about the Supreme Court, and does the First Amendment trump all?
Well, I mean, you know, here's the thing about the First Amendment. It often protects that which most people find incredibly objectionable and sometimes offensive and sometimes obscene. That's really wild, you know, and I think that that's in many ways the way the First Amendment was intended. I'm not sure if the Supreme Court could have ruled any other way. So, look, as objectionable as these protests are to people, the First Amendment does protect speech, and I think that's obviously how the Supreme Court interpreted it.
Dan Dobby, your thoughts?
Well, I think it's just an interesting example of just how strong those First Amendment protections are. I mean, you couldn't imagine a more offensive group of protesters than these people from Westboro Church, which, as I understand it, is mainly family members of a pastor anyway, who was drummed out of his previous work as a lawyer for, I believe, insulting a witness. These are what they say is hateful. It offends the parents of the bereaved. It's the idea that all of America should suffer because of homosexuality. You couldn't really think of anything more objectionable. And yet, even this language, which I have to say is pretty close to the kind of hate speech which is banned by many countries, was upheld by this ringing 8-1 verdict by the Supreme Court. Mm.
Jack Beatty, I want to turn to you on a couple of other points here as we wrap up this hour. I know you have a story that you'd like to share today. At the last of this nation's heroic World War I veterans has passed.
Yes, Corporal Frank Buckles, who lied about his age to get into the Army in 1917, died at 110 years old in West Virginia, our last veteran. My father was a veteran of World War I, and he conveyed affecting memories of London under bombardment by German dirigibles, of a brawl in a pub between American sailors and English soldiers, of mustering the nerve to ask a Paris lady for a kiss, and above all of the dozens of flag-draped coffins of his shipmates from the USS Mount Vernon, torpedoed by a German submarine in the Bay of Biscay, arrayed along a Brest dock, and his captain weeping during the memorial service and the tears soaking his blouse. So to all the veterans of World War I, rest in peace. Mm.
And Jane Russell, we should note, died this week. I mentioned that earlier, at the age of 89. Take us to a story about her, Jack.
Well, yes, this is from her autobiography, My Path and My Detours, which I recommend. I've read it. And she tells a story of going to Chicago for the first time with her husband, Bob Waterfield, the quarterback for the Los Angeles Rams. They're having a game with the Bears. And the coach said, wives stay in one wing of the hotel, I believe it was the Drake Hotel, and husbands stay in the other. No, they're not going to associate tonight, the game night. And no one told Jane Russell that, to do that sort of thing. So she put on her mink coat, and that was all she put on, walked across the hallway of the hotel, the other wing, goes up to her Bob Waterfield's door, bangs on the door. The roommate comes out, sees Jane wrapped in her her fur and says, "I'm leaving, I'm leaving." And Jane said, "We broke the curfew that night." So rest in peace, too, to Jane Russell.
At 89. Let's go to another call here. Heath is in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Heath. Welcome to the program. Glad you waited so long. Thanks.
Hi, Jane. I just wanted to interject into a previous conversation that you guys were having concerning a Republican nomination for president. I just want to get your thoughts on Ron Paul. He won the CPAC poll the last couple of years. He's immensely popular with the conservative youth, and he's also has a foreign policy which would really cut some needed dollars in the Pentagon's budget. If you could, just give me yours and Jackson's thoughts on that.
All right, Heath, thank you. Aaron Billings, I'll turn to you. What about Ron Paul? We talked about Newt Gingrich. What about Ron Paul and perhaps others?
I mean, Ron Paul certainly has a following. I don't think he can win the nomination, and I think most people would agree with that. But he does have a following. I kind of see him as the original Tea Party member. You know, I kind of see him as, he really champions those same issues, those same priorities of the Tea Party. And if he gets in the race, he's always interesting, and he always adds to the debate. So. I wouldn't be surprised if he throws his hat in. Mitt Romney certainly is viewed as kind of the front runner right now. But there are others. You know, obviously Haley Barbour is considering a bid. We obviously talked about Newt Gingrich earlier. Sarah Palin is in the mix. You know, some people are pushing Mike Huckabee to run. We could have a very large field. I applaud it. I welcome it. I think that the Democratic nomination last presidential cycle was fascinating. I hope we see a similar large crowd on the Republican side heading into 2012.
More to come. Aaron Billings is deputy editor of Roll Call. Aaron, thanks so much, as always, for joining us.
You bet.
Dan Dombey is U.S. diplomatic correspondent for the Financial Times. Dan, great to have you as well.
Thank you.
And On Point's Jack Beattie. Have a nice weekend, Jack.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Huang, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Kate Osborne, and James Ross. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Have a good weekend. This is On Point.